Today on the 21st Show, John Hibbing is a renowned political scientist who works at the intersection of psychology and politics. His latest book explores what motivates President Trump's base and why those forces are likely to outlast Trump himself. Then we'll talk with Sherman Dilla Thomas, Chicago's neighborhood historian. He makes history videos on TikTok that have gained him tens of thousands of followers. Now he's working on a new project with Netflix. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And for the rest of December, we're listening back to some of our favorite conversations from this year. For our first segment today, I want you to cast your memory back to the fall of 2020, before the election. Did you think President Trump was likely to win or lose? And if you thought he was going to lose, what did you think would happen next? John Hibbing saw clearly what many of us did not. Here's some of what he said on Twitter on September 30th, 2020, a little than a month before the election. He said, quote, "Trump will lose in November. He will challenge the results. His diehard base will take to the streets, and the fate of our precious democracy will be in the hands of Republicans." Hibbing is one of the foremost social scientists in America today. In recent years, his work has focused on the intersection of biology, psychology, and politics. Books he's written or co-authored include Stealth Democracy, Americans' Beliefs About How Government Should Work, Predisposed, Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences, and from 2020, and perhaps most relevant to our discussion today, The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base and Why It Matters for the Post-Trump Era. That book was written after speaking with and surveying many diehard Trump supporters. And I would imagine that's why his pre-election assertion about what would happen after the election was so prescient. John Hibbing is Foundation Regent University Professor in Political Science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he joined us for this conversation back in September. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls live today, but you can always let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121, or email talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. All right, here now is John Hibbing on his most recent book, The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base and Why It Matters for the Post-Trump Era. Let's start our conversation with something concrete and recent, right? Because there's a line of thinking in political commentary that President Trump supporters are authoritarian followers, that what they really crave is a strong leader. But if that's the case, why did they resist COVID recommendations?
Well, good. I'm glad you brought up that very point, because I think that's one of many instances in which the authoritarian label really doesn't fit. And I think we need to be careful here, because a lot of times people use the word authoritarian simply to refer to somebody who's not deeply committed to democracy. And if that's the case, then I think that's true of Donald Trump as well as many of his supporters. But if you take it a little bit more literally, that this is someone who really is, you know, desirous of having a strong authority figure. That's how we use the word in terms of a family situation, a domineering father usually. Then I think it doesn't fit. You mentioned one of the reasons, certainly, the response to COVID. There was actually the response to Trump himself. I don't know if you remember this, when he gave a speech, I think it was Mississippi or Alabama, and he kind of timidly mentioned that maybe getting vaccinated wasn't all a bad idea, and he was booed robustly. So, and you have that, and then of course you have January 6th, which I think it's very difficult to look at those events where some of Trump's supporters were, threatening to hang the vice president of the United States and attacking police officers. That just to me does not look like an authoritarian. So that's why I kind of went in a different direction and cooked up this word securitarian, which I thought was a little bit better descriptor of what they were feeling.
And we can talk a little bit about the policy implications of this. I'm reminded of that phrase, there go my people, I must follow them for I am their leader, right? But all right, let's talk about the work you did for the Securitarian Personality. How did you go about your research?
Well, you alluded to a little bit of it. I kind of had a two-pronged strategy. One, I wanted to just get a little bit of a feel in a more casual way, but a real world way. So I did attend several Trump rallies, and I would, you know, pigeonhole any of my students. I teach at the University of Nebraska, which is nice from this vantage point in that we really have a very mixed student body. Of course, Nebraska is a very conservative state. But on campus here, it's much more balanced because we get a lot of students from Omaha and Lincoln, which are a little bit more liberal. So the point is, most of my classes are really nicely balanced between people on the right and people on the left and people in the middle. So, you know, I would make it a point to really discuss things with my students, especially those who had a desire to embrace Donald Trump. In my extended family, I have several strong Trump supporters, so I would talk to them. We did focus groups, which are just kind of a casual way of getting, you know, in this case, about 10 or 11 strong Trump supporters in a group and sitting down and discussing with them what they like about Trump, what they don't, what attracts them to him. But then also on the second prong was really to do more of a systematic study. So I was able to get funds to commission two surveys, nationwide surveys. And what I was really interested there was trying to kind of tease out the differences between conservatives who strongly supported Donald Trump and conservatives who did not strongly support Donald Trump. I wanted to see what it was that really kind of animated Trump's base. So those were basically the strategies that I employed.
So before we get into the details of your analysis about, you know, what constitutes a securitarian personality, maybe we should just spend a little more time talking about the authoritarian idea, because even the title of your book is a riff on this landmark political science book called The Authoritarian Personality, right? What is that?
Right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, the notion of authoritarianism is it really grew out of kind of post-World War II, where several scholars were very, you know, very eager to understand what motivated the fascist movement in Europe. And to a great extent in the United States, you know, we had a lot of sentiments, pro-German sentiments and pro-fascist sentiments in the United States. And they want to understand what motivated those prejudices. Many of these scholars were Jewish, so you can understand they had a special interest in this. And their basic conclusion was that there was this really clear authoritarian personality style. And this was someone who craved authority. They perhaps had lived under an authoritarian parent. And then as a result of that, they sought out these kinds of leaders that would just tell them what to do. It would fill a void in their life by giving them direction. And so this was a big hit. It was controversial. I mean, people didn't like the idea of kind of saying that there was a certain personality type. They wanted to believe that this was more environmental rather than something that really bubbled up from the very nature of a person. So, and that dispute, by the way, continues today and maybe is something we'll want to touch on in our discussion. So that authoritarian idea was something that was really strongly felt in both psychology and political science and in the public sector as well.
Okay, if you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation with John Hibbing about his book, The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base and Why It Matters for the Post-Trump Era. It explores the views and lives of many diehard Trump supporters, and it predicted, basically, the January 6th insurrection. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls live, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, so what are the components, then, of a securitarian personality? How does that differ from what the authoritarian personality wanted?
Right, so a lot of times, I maybe should have mentioned this in your previous question, that authoritarianism is frequently mentioned by asking people about how they think children should best be raised. That's, I think, is kind of a clever strategy. You know, for example, a survey item might be, if you had the choice between raising children to be obedient and raising them to be creative, which would you select? And so someone who says obedient will tilt toward the authoritarian side of the ledger. So you have a lot of questions like that.
What I found was that... If your baby cries, what is the George Lakoff has that line, if your baby cries in the middle of the night, do you go to them because they need to be loved and comforted, or do they need to like tough it out and learn that the world is tough and they'll cry themselves to sleep, sort of thing?
That's good. Yeah, no, that's a very good comparison, and you're right to bring up Lakoff. He talks a lot about authoritarian kinds of language. But what I found was that when I asked the conservatives who loved Trump and conservatives who didn't those questions, there was really very little difference. That did not discriminate the strong Trump supporters. So I kind of went in search of what did discriminate, since it wasn't the authoritarian idea. And I found that really any question that had to do with strength or with kind of vigilance or protection against outsiders, that was really what seemed to differentiate strong Trump supporters from conservatives who didn't. It wasn't, you know, questions like abortion or gay marriage, or especially things on taxes, you know, capital gains taxes, size of government. Trump supporters and other conservatives were fairly similar on those. Where I saw the massive differences would be anything that had to do with immigration, English as a national language, protests during the national anthem. You know, those were the kinds of things that really distinguished. So this is where I came up with the word securitarian, because it seemed to me these were individuals who wanted to protect themselves. Gun rights are very important to them. Strong defense. They wanted to protect themselves, but also protect the country. What they saw as the core of the country, insiders, the kind of dominant historical religion, and language group, racial group, all these things. That to me seemed to be the essence of Trump's strong supporters.
And so in that way, is it really the Trump himself, his personality, is that what people like? Or is it that he's echoing their views back to them? And this is where we get at that idea where he's constrained by his supporters on these core issues. You mentioned the example where he suggested sort of timidly, maybe people might want to get vaccinated, and he was booed. And we stopped hearing that from him at that point. You have a line in the book that he, at least before the past 2 years, he could have nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. His supporters would have stayed with him. But if he had suggested, you know, changing gun laws or easing border policies, he probably would have lost them.
Yeah. In my opinion, Trump is not engaging in some kind of act. He's not being, you know, clever in the sense of saying, I know this, I don't really believe this, but this appeals to the people. You know, you can go back a long way with Trump. I keep recalling his experience with the so-called Central Park Five, a group of five African-American youths who were charged with violent crimes. And, you know, it looked like they didn't do it. But Trump took out, what, an $80,000 ad, I think, in the New York Times to make the case that they had done it. And so, you know, I think this is something that these securitarian attitudes, I think, run really deep with Donald Trump as well. And I think Trump supporters are pretty on guard for people who are just, you know, engaging in kind of an act. And I think they'd spot it if he was. And I think what makes it work for Donald Trump is that he really believes this. He is deeply committed to the core of America. And I think he is threatened by what he sees as outsiders and people who don't belong in that core.
Okay, if you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation with John Hibbing about his book, The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base and Why It Matters for the Post-Trump Era. It explores the views and lives of many diehard Trump supporters, and it predicted, basically, the January 6th insurrection. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls live, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Are there securitarians in American politics that are outside of Trump's base?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what's happening is, I don't know if this is kind of where you're going with that question.
Well, you have a line, I'll be more clear than you have a, toward, at one point in the book, you talk about how black voters in particular have strong Democratic voting predilections, if you will, but they do have some you know, ideas in common with securitarian personality. And so I wondered, and there has been a lot of talk about how Trump made inroads with voters that a lot of people thought he had no chance with in the 2020 election, particularly voters of color. And I guess that's what I was wondering about.
Gotcha. Thanks. I think the situation with regard to African-Americans in the U.S. and also Hispanic voters is really kind of fascinating, because here, if you believe that my survey questions, which would ask things like, you know, is it important for you for America to be militarily strong and things like that? You get a sizable minority, both African Americans and Hispanics in the U.S., that say yes. There's a lot of securitarian sentiments in there. A lot of people think that Hispanics and African Americans are a little bit more conservative than white Democrats because of simply attitudes on abortion and gay marriage. But that's not true. I think it's a little broader than that. So you've got that sentiment that exists. But you also have the fact that, you know, these are Trump and a lot of his supporters are viewing those very African-Americans and Hispanics who have securitarian attitudes as outsiders just because of their skin color. So I think that's what's going on there. And that's what pushes a lot of minority members, even though they might have securitarian tendencies, to vote Democrat, since they still aren't viewed as outsiders or as insiders themselves.
I do want to ask, because I'm anticipating, I'm sure you heard this in your research, I anticipate there might be some people listening to us right now who think, you know what, Trump supporters are, you know, they're racist or they're fascists. What more do you need to know? Why is it important to do this kind of work that you've done?
Well, I think that attitude, and you're right, is prevalent. I can't tell you how many times people would say, what are you working on? And I'd say, I'm trying to understand Trump supporters. And they say, oh, that's easy. They're just racist. And, you know, why? That's going to be a very short book. You know, I think I kind of understand that attitude, but I also think it's dangerous. That doesn't do us any good. You know, if you just dismiss them like that, and if you never understand what they're really thinking, there's not going to be any opportunity to have any kind of dialogue or to compromise. So, you know, they are convinced they're not racist. And so I think it's important to at least understand how they can view their position as not being racist. And I think in order to saying something's racist, that ends debate rather than begins it. And I think that's exactly what we need to avoid.
All right. We need to take a short break. When we come back, the rest of our conversation with John Hibbing. His most recent book is The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base, and why it matters for the post-Trump era. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today we're listening back to our conversation with the political scientist John Hibbing about his book, The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base, and Why It Matters for the Post-Trump Era. In the book, Hibbing explored the lives of diehard Trump supporters, and he was one of the earliest predictors of the unrest to follow the 2020 election. Because our show is on tape today, we're not taking calls live, but let us know what you thought. Leave a voicemail anytime, day or night, 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Or email us, talk@21stshow.org is the address, talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is the conclusion of my conversation with John Hibbing. John Hibbing, you touched on this idea a little earlier about nature versus nurture, and I know you've spent a lot of time studying this, as I said, the biology of political differences. If it's not too personal to ask, could you slap your father in the face with his permission as part of a comedy skit?
Right. Excellent question. So for the listeners, this is one of the kinds of items that are frequently asked in order to ascertain people's personality. And I guess
for what it's worth, I would say yes, I could with he would say yes, but I would have a hard time doing it. So take that for what it's worth.
Right. And, you know, the people who come up with these questions, they also say you can't game the thing. You know, in other words, you can't tell your father later that the only reason you did that was you know, because of this setup, that it was artificial. So they try to get real responses. And sometimes they'll even say, how much money would it take for you to do these various things? So in this way, they can uncover whether you have leanings toward being conscientious or, you know, loyal and all these things. And so what you want an answer from me, I guess I would say I would have trouble doing that.
Why is that question important to understanding of politics in America today?
Well, I think, you know, I guess the way I'd approach that is to say, at the kind of core of my approach to political science is that politics needs to be seen as just part of who we are as people. And I think there's some individuals out there who think, well, politics is just something that kind of gets slapped on top. It's surface deep is all. If we just talk to these people a little bit more or present them with some evidence that they'll change their views, we can get them to come around. They'll be rational and persuadable. And I think that might be a little bit too glib, too optimistic a view. I think that a lot of our political beliefs cut to the core of us, just like our personalities. And therefore, the kinds of questions that you just brought up kind of start to blend together your approach to life and your personality and also your approach to politics. I mean, politics is basically just people's preferences about the structure of social life. And that is something that's been really important to us, even when we were hunter-gatherers, you know, back hundreds of thousands of years ago. We had to get along with each other. We had to kind of figure out what we're going to do when somebody comes over from the tribe across the river and tries to join our tribe. How are we going to approach that? So I think we've been dealing with these things, and that's the way, that's just a little bit of background about how I approach these questions. I think we do need to see politics as part of a very larger orientation to life.
Well, if a lot of our political dispositions are biologically hardwired, what are the normative implications of that? I mean, right? Maybe we find out some people are genetically bad for small d democracy. What do we do with that information?
Well, first of all, I hope this isn't a tangent, but I have to kind of jump on what you just said. You know, I think in a way that almost all humans are not very well equipped for small d democracy. And maybe this speaks to the kind of theme of your series here, which I applaud, by the way. I think it's just right on target. But I do think we have to recognize that human beings are not particularly well equipped for democracy. Democracy asks a lot of us. It means that you have to put up with people who disagree with you, unless you're like Rousseau and have, you know, a democracy of just a couple of dozen people who agree with you. In a realistic setting, in a large country with a heterogeneous population, you're going to have these deep disagreements that can be extremely frustrating. It's democracy is about compromise with those who don't agree with you. It's also about losers. I tell my students this, and they always roll their eyes. Democracy is for losers. It really, what we're structuring here is a system in which people who did not succeed in getting their leaders in power are not going to be abused and taken advantage of to a great extent. They're going to have a fair chance in the next election. Their religion is not going to be demeaned or taken away, their basic culture. So there are protections there, constitutional protections. So I think in that sense, we have to recognize, I think this is a really important thing for all of us to realize how challenging democracy is, especially in a heterogeneous society.
Well, and that puts me in mind of my first introduction to your work, which was the book Stealth Democracy, which you co-authored with your Nebraska colleague, Elizabeth Tice Morse. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that now, because I think that still, to me, to my reading of it, informs a lot of what is happening in American politics today. And so if I may, I'll just sort of briefly summarize this thumbnail summary and correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, the idea is that people are angry about politics, but it's not because they don't like the sort of policy outcomes of our system. They don't like the process. And there's three reasons for that. People misunderstand how much other people agree with them on what the public agenda should be. People don't like self-interested policymakers. And as you indicated, they have this really intense dislike of the arguments and the mess that is just inherent in democratic government. So maybe we can take those just briefly in turn. How do people misunderstand how much agreement there is on public policy goals?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Especially interesting in that the research you alluded to is something that my colleague and I did almost a quarter of a century ago. Really, we did the surveys on which that book was based, I think, in the late 90s. So it's interesting to kind of reflect on that. And so we claim that people certainly did not appreciate the degree to which there was disagreement in America. A lot of the people in our focus groups and in the survey would just say, well, you know, why can't they just make this work? Just listen to people and do it.
Just get in a room, make it happen. Yeah,
that's right. And as though, you know, there isn't going to be any disagreement. And our kind of comeback was, well, really? I mean, don't you appreciate how much people disagree with each other? And I think this is something we need to wrestle with. I hope this personal anecdote doesn't go too far down that road, but my wife and I have kind of an acreage, and we had a guy do some dirt work with a bulldozer and backhoe, and he was fun to talk to, but he just can't understand how anybody supports Joe Biden. And the reason, not that, you know, that doesn't make sense to him, he doesn't associate with anybody who does. He works in a kind of construction area in rural Nebraska for the most part, and nobody he comes into contact with likes Joe Biden. So I think, and therefore he just kind of projects it. He said that, you know, then there must be something wrong if Biden wins the election. And I think sometimes we see the same thing on the reverse. I live in an academic setting, and almost everybody is liberal. And some of my colleagues just have a difficult time appreciating how many people are not, sharing their political beliefs. So now this is, I started to say, this is something that may have changed in 25 years, you know, given, you know, the, well, the, you know, Barack Obama, we'll go back to George W. Bush was the most polarizing president ever until Barack Obama came along, and Barack Obama was until Donald Trump came along. So, you know, we've had a series of incredibly polarizing presidencies because it's an incredibly polarizing era. So maybe people have come to realize this a little bit more than Beth and I let on when we wrote that book. On the other hand,
I feel like the information bubbles we all live in today maybe are amplifying that effect to some extent.
That's right. So that's the argument on the other side, that it could be worse because we are so capable these days of, you know, isolating ourselves from information that we don't agree with. So, you know, that still may be the case, that we simply don't appreciate the depths of disagreement.
Well, we can, one of the other things that people wanted are non-self-interested policymakers. I think the phrase you had in the book was empathetic, non-self-interested decision makers. I don't think anyone could accuse, well, I don't know, maybe they could. Do you think President Trump, does he fit into that empathetic, non-self-interested decision maker rubric?
Well, I think he might for some of his followers. One of the things that I heard repeatedly when I was talking to people was that Donald Trump's already rich. So therefore, he's not going to be making decisions in order to feather his own nest and make himself richer. I there could be some problems with that argument. But my point is that to some of his strong supporters, that was the case. They liked the idea that he was a businessman. He wasn't a politician. He really didn't need to get an office in order to become rich. He was already filthy rich, especially if you believe him. So, I think there might have been a little bit of that involved in support for Trump as well.
And I'm sure people who are not his supporters would say they don't see him as an empathetic person, not in the, I guess, the way a liberal person would define empathetic. Well, then the last point of this is the idea, and you talked about this a little bit, but I think this is worth pausing and expanding on, is this idea that democracy is supposed to be messy. Like, I interview public officials, politicians all the time, and they, you know, there are some who just say, they're playing politics with this. But it's like, well, that's the point, right? People are supposed to disagree about these things because people disagree about things. Talk about how, you know, people want to see this false consensus in politics.
Yeah, you're right. That it's not just lay people, but also politicians that do like to foster this this idea. Like, you know, they're different than everybody else. And, you know, back in Washington, they're doing all these terrible things. And, if you just elect people like me, then it's simple. I'll listen to what you say and I'll do what you want me to do. And I think they are downplaying the degree to which, there are differences of opinion. And what are you going to do? In my state right now, we have a gubernatorial election coming up, and one of the candidates has refused to engage in any debates. And he says, well, I do a lot of town meetings, and that's good enough. So people don't need to know any more about me than that. And I think that's really unfortunate, because we need to kind of understand how people think on their feet and what they're going to do with complicated questions. And if you don't do that, then I don't know how people are going to make an informed decision about who to vote for.
Okay, if you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation with John Hibbing about his book, The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base and Why It Matters for the Post-Trump Era. It explores the views and lives of many diehard Trump supporters, and it predicted, basically, the January 6th insurrection. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls live, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Randy is on line one from Peoria County. Randy, thank you for calling in. We've got just a few minutes, so please go ahead.
Yeah, what the professor is opening up here is incredibly vital. I've always tended towards the liberal side, but what is so important here, President Trump would touch a nerve that sometimes overrode everything ugly that he did. And it doesn't make a liberal person a racist to then go, oh my goodness, I'm almost willing to overlook everything else for the security that would bring. The issue I'm so concerned about is what happens in a pluralistic society when we're so kind, we open our doors almost to this this jihadic notion that come and live with us. And then, like in other societies where they've taken over, and then they push out the other religions, all of the other religions, because in their world, they need to be obedient. They jihad the others, and all of a sudden...
All right, Randy, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're just so short on time. I want to make sure that Professor Hibbing has time to weigh in on what you had to say there. I'm sorry to interrupt, but thank you for the call. Professor, what do you make of that?
Well, I especially liked where Randy was going at the beginning about the danger of having this attitude that the ends justifies the means, and that we can just, you know, that the ends are so important. And I think you get this actually to some extent on both sides of the political aisle on occasion. But now it's a little bit more visible on the right that you know, that from a strong Trump supporter's perspective, it's just so important that we protect the core of America from these outsiders that, you know, we might have to sacrifice some aspects of democracy. And I think that's that attitude, whether it's on the left or the right, is we really have to guard against, because, you know, if we weaken the basic structures of democracy, then we're not going to have these protections for people who have not got their way.
Joel tweeted us at 21st Show, wants to know what you have to say about the Trump slogan, Make America Great Again. You went to a Trump rally, you write in the book. You wore an American flag hat. You did not don a red hat to go fully incognito. But Joel wants to know, to what time period is his base referring? And was it a stellar era for all U.S. citizens?
Yeah, I'm not sure we could give a specific, you know, year, but the way I view that is, and I think that's really reflective of the attitude, is that America was great when it was dominated by this core. And I'm starting to sound like a broken record here, but the, Christian, straight, white, those are all kinds of things that they see as being at the core of this. And, you know, what I think is fascinating is we see these same kinds of attitudes in lots of other places. You know, even Sweden just now had an election and the right moved in, and they're very opposed to immigration from the Middle East and elsewhere. So, you know, it's about 20% of the population in a large number of countries, which I think is just fascinating. And that's about the estimate, by the way, that I get for these ardent Trump supporters, about 20% of the population. So that to me kind of is fascinating. And I guess so my answer to Joel would be it's not a particular year so much as a vision of America where this core was dominant.
Well, John Hibbing, I'm afraid we're out of time, but this has been a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate you making the time to speak with us today on the 21st Show.
No, thank you for taking my work seriously, Brian. I really appreciate it.
And I just want to end with a short excerpt from the book. He says, after observing intense Trump supporters interacting with equally intense Trump opponents, it is impossible to conclude that they are cut from the same cloth but just happen to disagree temporarily on one issue or another. Political differences run incredibly deep, and interlocutors have very little chance of effecting meaningful change in those with whom they fundamentally disagree. John Hibbing's most recent book is The Securitarian Personality, What Really Motivates Trump's Base, and Why It Matters for the Post-Trump Era. Coming up after the break, our conversation with Sherman Dilla Thomas. He's gone viral on TikTok, making history videos about Chicago and Illinois. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For the rest of the month, we're listening back to some of our favorite segments from this year. Now, for a certain type of person, Chicago is the nexus of the universe. The food, the music, the sports, the culture, and the history. And among the city's best exports are odes to its very greatness, from Carl Sandburg's stormy, husky, brawling City of the Big Shoulders to Nelson Algren's City on the Make. Now, a new generation is using new media to celebrate the city in a garden.
Yo, what's up? It's your favorite neighborhood historian, Dilla. I thought today was a good day to remind you why Chicago is the greatest city on earth. First up, the homie Dick Biondi. A longtime staple on Chicago radio, you can thank Dick Biondi for being the first DJ in America to play the Beatles. And we all know the history of Beatles mania. Next up is the classic Murphy's Bed. And no, Chicago didn't invent the Murphy's Bed, but Chicagoan Sarah E. Good did invent the folding cabinet bed, which is the precursor of the Murphy's Bed. And since we're on the subject of inventions that make our lives easier, I thought I'd let you know that it was another dope Chicago woman that invented the dishwasher. Chicagoan Josephine Cochran premiered her invention at the 1893 Columbian World's Exposition. And even though I was the dishwasher in my house, it's still a pretty dope invention. If you're traveling across the country, you can tell someone what time to pick you up and they'll be on time because Chicago set the nation's time zones. Greatest city on earth.
That's Sherman Dilla Thomas, better known to his 81,000 followers on TikTok as Chicago's neighborhood historian. He joined us back in February to discuss using the social media platform to share the history of the Windy City. Because our program is on tape today, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought of our conversation by leaving us a voicemail at 217-300-2121, 217-300-2121, or send us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. Okay, here now is my conversation with Dilla. So what got you into the history of Chicago?
My father primarily. I'm coming to learn that I've always been history-minded, so to speak, but in particular, just studying the history of Chicago so intently that comes from my father. He was a Chicago police officer for 32 years. He had a couple of very historic details. He was a member of Harold Washington's bodyguard detail, Eugene Sawyer's. And when people like Carol Moseley Braun or Bobby Rush were in town, he was always a part of those details. And so when you're around people making history, they're aware of it and they talk about others who made history. And curious about the names they would say, right? I was too young to know who William Dawson was, but they certainly talked about him, or Oscar DePreece. And so, you know, when I left my father, I would research some of the names that I would hear them say, so that the next time I was with those folks, or, you know, just with my father, I can impress him and jump in the conversation. So a lot of study like that is gotten me into Chicago history.
That's so interesting. He was on Harold Washington's security detail. Do you know, was he selected because he was Black? I mean, it was such a divisive, you know, a lot of the ethnic white politicians in the city really kind of went to war with Washington.
Oh, yes, they did. That's for sure. So he was selected because he was a member of the African-American Police League. And so Harold Washington himself went to a gentleman by the name of Howard Sappho. He said, I want you to pick my detail, but I want them all to be members of the league. And just very briefly, the African-American Police League sued the city of Chicago over the entrance exam for both police and firefighters due to being culturally biased, and they won a consent decree. And so if you see like a Black sergeant, or right now we just celebrated the first African-American fire commissioner, that's because of that organization.
Fascinating. All right. So you're into history already. What about TikTok? How'd you get into TikTok as the media?
Well, see, that's a whole nother story, right? Like I got seven kids, and they're not the littlest ones, but most of them are on TikTok. When my eight-year-old came to me and she wanted to get on TikTok, I thought that was like a little young for a social media app, but I didn't really know what it was, so I didn't want to give her an immediate no. I just said, hey, create a profile for me and we'll do it together. And so I came to find out real quickly that the daughters want their dads to do like these choreographed dances with them. I tried a few, just, you know, trying to be cool dad, and they were terrible. My friends would send them back to me, teasing me all day. And so I was like, hey, babe. But more to the point, she was kind of disappointed that it was garnering the views that she thought they deserved. And so I said, hey, baby, like, if you let me tell you why 312 is our area code, or if you let me, you know, teach you how to describe the war between who the actual deep dish founder is, we'll get a million views. And she was like, man, that's nerd stuff. And don't nobody care about that. And so just like trying to coach her along, I started doing them. And people seemed to like them, so I kept doing them.
That's a great story. Is she proud of you now? You got 80,000 followers?
She thinks she's my agent. It's so funny, you know, like if somebody wants to take a picture of me, she demands that they take a picture of her too, because she discovered me, as she says.
Oh, that's great. All right, so you're going to be featured in a TV special called Black History Verified on CW Channel 26, airing this weekend. What's that all about?
I love that they thought enough of me to kind of let me host it and do a little bit of co-host it, do a little bit of writing on it. We're just highlighting lesser known Chicagoans, the Black Chicagoans that have made a national impact, you know. Sometimes, especially nowadays, things are so polarizing. Black History Month kind of gets wrapped up in this "it's only for Black people" thing. And it's just to remind us all that America is like really, really cool. You know, in this particular month, let's talk about why Black people make it cool. We can talk about whoever any month you want. So on that show, we're highlighting people like Dr. Margaret Burroughs, who, if you don't live outside of Chicago, you may not know about. Or we're talking about the great Earl B. Dickerson. So just highlighting lesser known Chicagoans and their impact on our city, but the country.
All right. So that's a great segue into, I wanted to do something a little different than we usually do on the show today and borrow something from the podcast host, Tyler Cowen. He does a segment called Underrated or Overrated. I'm just going to throw a couple of names or topics and ideas out there. And I want to know if you think they're underrated or overrated. So if you're cool with that, I'm going to start with Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable.
Oh, he's madly underrated.
Why is that?
His father was a French pirate, and he went and rescued his son from Haiti, and they crash landed in New Orleans. And by the time Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable was in his 20s, he could speak French, Spanish, English, Haitian patois, and several Native American dialects. And this was like the 1770s, and I bet nobody that heard me just say that has ever heard that before.
Absolutely. All right. Underrated or overrated? William G. Edens.
You know what? He's underrated too, only because he has an expressway, but he never owned a car.
And can you just remind our listeners who he was?
Oh, so he was a very early safe road pioneer here in Chicago. Just believed in, you know, we formerly had like plank roads, and they lay it down once, they'd be like the most dangerous things ever. And then when we went to what they then called horseless carriages, it was even worse. So William Edens was a early pioneer in safe roads, and he's the guy that the Edens Expressway is named for.
All right, we're speaking with Sherman Dilla Thomas, known as Chicago's neighborhood historian. He's big on TikTok, and we're doing a sort of a lightning round, underrated or overrated. Earl Dickerson, you mentioned his name a few minutes ago.
Man, that's probably, in my opinion, the most underrated Chicagoan of the 20th century, for sure. The very important dude. He was the lawyer for Lorraine Hansberry's father. We've all famously seen or read A Raisin in the Sun. And the reason that racial covenants end in this country is because of the precedent he set in 1940 with the Supreme Court.
Also founded the Beta chapter of Kappa Alpha Psi at the U of I, I understand.
Yes, he did. Very cool man. He's also the only Black founder of the American Legion.
All right. Another underrated, overrated, 773.
That's overrated.
Why? Overrated. Why?
Especially now, like kids today really, really like get 773 tatted on them and all that. And I remember when we were all pissed off that we were going to get 773. First, we had to do with area codes. Okay, fine, we'll take it. You know, well, the separation between the suburbs and the city, at least. But then only downtown got to keep the 312 area code. And that's our original area code. And 312 matters because it was put in position when we were the second largest population in the country. So that's important. So 773 is just something they pulled out of the air. It doesn't have any kind of meaning at all. 312 has like meaning and purpose. It's a reason why it's set that way.
Yeah. I grew up in Riverdale in the South Suburbs. I can remember when we had 312 when I was a kid. That changed a long time ago. All right. Underrated or overrated? No ketchup on hot dogs.
I'm going to say underrated because you ain't going to make any Chicagoans mad at me.
All right. Underrated or overrated? The Chicago Cubs.
Ooh, they just added me on Twitter and now they're following me. So I just want to say, hey, Chicago Cubs, you guys are awesome. I'm not going to say that. They're overrated.
Thank you.
They are overrated.
That is the correct answer. All right. Last one, a little more serious. Zero tolerance discipline policies in schools. Underrated or overrated?
My goodness, it is. It's grossly overrated. It doesn't leave room for change. It doesn't leave room for. I fancy myself a pretty smart dude. I did as a kid. Right? I was just always interested in learning, and it didn't leave room for even people like me. Like you have a kid who never had any kind of trouble, criminal or other. But if he happens to get into a fight or something, he falls on the other side of your rule, he's kicked out of school. And I'm fortunate enough to where I was the only dude on my block that had a two-parent household. People had granddads in their household. I was literally only father in the house. And so I was able to come up out of that, the zero tolerance policy affecting me. But a lot of my friends end up in jail and worse because of it. So it was like one of the worst things we could have done.
All right. So you also, in addition to TikTok and these TV projects that's coming up on the CW for people who are in Northern Illinois, Channel 26 this weekend, Black History Verified, that's on February 12th. I understand you're working on something with Netflix too. What can you say about that?
So they tell me I got to like say it better than that, because boy have I been getting in trouble. So I am working with the and this is just like to educate everybody, right? So sometimes Netflix will say like, hey, we want to make this thing, and it's an original thought from the people upstairs in Netflix, but 85% of the stuff you see on their platform is done by a production company, Sugar 23 production, Time production, something like that. And so I wrote a treatment for the production company that did the Chicago Party On with Chris Witowski and Richie. Mm-hmm. And they pitched the show as being the production company. And then I'm writing the pilot now. So that's the whole better way to say it. What's going on. And it's totally awesome. I just submitted like the first act. I'm learning like that's how you do it too. You submit pages, they edit it, you send it back just so it flows. And either they're like gassing me up to keep me going, or we're getting ready to win an Emmy, but everybody seems to love this thing.
What can you say what it's about?
It's a period piece about a Chicago politician. Something occurs in Chicago's history. I mean, that's like loose, and I'm sorry. We're following a Chicago politician through a scandal.
You got to keep it close to the chest, I guess. All right.
Yeah, I got to wait for them to like write the check. You know, if I like say it too soon, somebody will beat me.
Fair enough. All right. Well, I hope we can have you back when you are big on Netflix someday in the future, or maybe after your Emmy. Last thing I want to ask you about, you do bus tours, I understand. How can people do that? What would they learn on one of your bus tours?
I'm so proud and honored that you asked that. And I want to thank you for including that. You can book my tours at chicagomahogany.com, all one word, chicagomahogany.com. And you're going to learn about stuff that you walk past all the time, and you may not pay any attention to it. It's Black History Month. And the building that they started, Negro History Week, like as a concept, is still standing. It's on 37th and Wabash. I'm going to show you that. But also, if you take a Bridgeport tour, those are the people who hand dug and reversed, you know, the Chicago Canal and they reversed Chicago River. They hand dug a lot of the Chicago Canal. They're also the people that worked in McCormick Reaper's works. And so I show you some of what's still standing of the old Bridgeport factories. If we go to Roseland, they have some of the most amazing churches in the country, and the brickwork that our Polish Chicagoans did is outstanding. So I point out those things. I try to like make cultural ties. I try to explain why the neighborhood has the borders that it does.
And that was my conversation with Dilla, a.k.a. Sherman Thomas, a.k.a. the neighborhood historian on TikTok. And that's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.